All right, so we're going to finish out today talking about NHL, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, particularly specifically follicular lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We're very happy to have Dr. Sonali Smith from the University of Chicago and Dr. Matt Lunning from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Everybody got here in spite of the government shutdown somehow. It's always interesting to watch the travels of the faculty. They try to get here. I think, Matt, you went through Atlanta and whatever. I heard you had an interesting experience.
Yeah, you know, I didn't expect a pit stop in Chattanooga.
All right. So we're going to start out, and again, we'll be particularly interested in talking about, there's so much new going on here, CAR-T, bispecifics that Matt's going to talk about. Matt, I always love your presentation. I can't wait to see how you put together this Formula One thing, but go for it.
Yeah, so thank you, Dr. Love, and welcome. I want to reflect on this morning. I was sitting having breakfast, and you know, you come to Orlando with family, right? And as I arrived at 2 a.m. This morning, I still saw the Florida Cancer Specialist family in the lobby.
Yes.
You guys were burning the midnight oil. But it's great to be invited here to give a talk about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma. And I left my Ricky Bobby outfit at home. I do have one. But the theme today is talking about where are we at with CAR T-cells, how do we choose which CAR T-cell, and also bispecifics. Which bispecific do we choose, when and where? So with that, I think it's great to start off with, it takes a pit crew to do not only CAR T cells, but to do CD3, CD20 bispecifics. And you're going to hear a little bit about CD3, CD19 bispecifics. And so I just want to walk you through what is the journey for a patient that's coming through the community to get to an authorized treatment center to do CAR T. So not only do you have to have the right disease space and acknowledge that is a patient who could go on to get CAR T, but also when you make that referral, the number of downstream people that it takes to do one CAR T cell. So not only are you looking at patient identification for the right time and place, but the logistical challenges of getting somebody from point A, which is their home, to point B, which is often their community oncologist's office, to point C, which is the authorized treatment center, can be logistically challenging. And then there's the financial aspect. Just like Dr. Love alluded to, I never thought that I would hear over the radio that there are no controllers in the tower at Jacksfield, Hartfield, International Airport, and you're being diverted to Chattanooga. Just like I never thought that I would be asking what the insurance of the patient is before I walk in to do the CAR T cell, and why. Because that helps me set the stage for what I may need to do from the pre-apheresis bridging period, post-apheresis, and ultimately getting them to their CAR T-cell, which is, at the end of the day, the goal. But many patients fall out over that pre- and post-apheresis period of time. I like to call it the brain-to-vein time, which I will state was created downstairs in the lobby of this hotel about 6 years ago. That's the real denominator that we think about trying to get to CAR T. So we now have two CAR T cells that are available to our patient population for high-risk diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, namely those with primary refractory large B-cell lymphoma, as well as those patients who have relapsed within 1 year from completion of their therapy. In my own practice now, I timestamp when the last cycle of Pola-R-CHP or R-CHOP was, because that ultimately starts that clock in that transplant-eligible patient population that also is likely to be CAR T-cell eligible. We learn this now through the sprint CAR race, which was ZUMA-7 and TRANSFORM. So ZUMA-7 with axi-cel and TRANSFORM with lysa-cel. Now, I could spend the next 7 minutes and 15 seconds dissecting this trial, but I'm not going to, because at the end of the day, they both had the same primary endpoint, which was event-free survival, and they both, in many ways, went head-to-head against our standard of care, which had been platinum-based chemotherapy, and if you achieved a response amenable to consolidative high-dose therapy and autologous stem cell rescue, you could. But what we see here is that many patients who are randomized into the standard of care arm did not even make it to the autologous stem cell transplant. So this is not two studies of CAR T cell versus transplant. This is CAR T cell versus what is reality in our clinic. Is that large B-cell lymphoma in the rituximab era, and when it relapses or is primary refractory, is a nasty disease. Fortunately, you can see here with 4-year follow-up from the ZUMA-7 trial and 3-year follow-up from the TRANSFORM trial, both CAR T cells won. What was ironic is that the control arm were very similar, meaning that the median EFS was almost a mirror image across both trials. But let's dig a little bit deeper. I'm going to dig into the ZUMA-7 trial because we should acknowledge where this field is going. You may start to see trials that after 4 cycles of anthracycline-based chemotherapy, if patients aren't achieving at least a PR, that those patients, maybe we should be stopping after 4 cycles and diverting to CAR T-cell, because the earlier we can get them to CAR T-cell with the least amount of disease, with the least amount of pissing off of the T-cells with our chemotherapy, may be better. And why? Well, you can see here in the ZUMA-7 trial, those primary refractory patients, yes, they had an EFS advantage, but they didn't have an OS advantage. Now, those late relapsing patients, those patients who got into a CR, in my opinion, regardless of that timing in that space, that was driving the overall survival advantage. So when you hear about ZUMA-12, when you hear about ZUMA-23, when you hear about early referral to CAR T-cell for that population who just isn't doing it with their frontline therapy, this is why. All right. Switching gears, all right, to go to the Le Mans, the 24-hour race, which is follicular lymphoma. Follicular lymphoma is a marathon. It is not a sprint. Fortunately, when patients get to CAR T-cell, those CAR T-cells work. Okay, you can see here axi-cel, 94% response rate, 79% CR rates. Tisa-cel, 86% overall response rate, 68% CR rate. And Lysacel coming in last to the manuscript, but I would say first in regards to efficacy with 94% CRs. Now, that's great, right? But if you're racing for 24 hours or 24 years in follicular lymphoma, durability matters. So at what cost? And here's what I think is great about CAR T-cell and follicular lymphoma, is you can see here, CR matters. We know it, we know it, we know it from large cell lymphoma, we see it in follicular lymphoma. If you can get these patients into a CR, that is where the durability lives. But look at the x-axis. These are in months. We need the x-axis to be measured in years in follicular lymphoma. Okay, so timing is everything when you pull the CAR T-cell out of the garage to run that race. The nice thing is you can see on the top curves here, it seems to be agnostic, just like in large B-cell lymphoma, to the bad follicular lymphomas, right? The ones that you know, the ones that you throw darts in and it's still coming back follicular lymphoma, it's like, gal darn it, clinically these people are transforming. That's often the time to pull the CAR T-cell out of the garage, and whether or not you're pulling Tisa-cel, axi-cel, or Lysacel, we will never have a 3-car race. All right, so switching gears to our three CD3, CD20 bispecifics, EPCO and Glofit. We know about these drugs in large B-cell lymphoma as an individual. Here are them parked side by side going too wide down your clinic. Nice here is that they're neck and neck. They have some differences with being sub-Q and continuous versus IV and fixed duration. But you can see here both have comparable CR rates. They're analyzed differently, I think just to confuse people like me who try to present the data to you. You can see here median PFS of those patients in CR at 37 months versus in Glofit, it's 57% met the median PFS at the time point here. But what we should be focusing on, I think, with bispecifics is the toxicity profile. You need to be prepared to manage fevers at 3 in the morning if you're giving bispecifics. Now, how you do that matters, right, to your clinic staff, to the patients, and to where you're sending them at 3 in the morning. And I really thought that lymphoma would be the shepherds for bispecifics, but I honestly think tarlatamab in small cell lung cancer will be the shepherd for lymphoma bispecifics. And so as you're gearing up your team to do bispecifics, I believe it's going to be through the lens of tarlatamab and not necessarily Glofit, Epco, or Mosun. Now, who's driving the benefit? We've seen a lot of chemo plus bispecific trials here that have now made it into the NCCN guidelines. I steer away from politics around the STARGLO trial. If you'd like to discuss it in the hallway, I'd be happy to share my sentiments on this regimen. I don't think it's going to go away from the NCCN guidelines. I do think that this will be regimens that I will continue to use. I may not use it exactly like the STARGLO trial for Glofit Gemox, where it beat hands down R-Gemox by itself and had an overall survival advantage regardless of geography. So what about Mosun and Tuzumab? So Mosun didn't quite make it alone in large B-cell lymphoma, but it is, I would say, the easiest dipping the toe in the water for our CD3, CD20 bispecifics, specifically in follicular lymphoma. And I've seen this in my practice, that this is a well-tolerated bispecific for my advanced age individuals who I'm really looking forward to doing fixed-duration therapy if the response is amenable to such after 8 treatments if they got into a CR. Why? Because I think down the road with all three of our CD3, CD20 bispecifics, we run into toxicity from infections. Some of the lowest immunoglobulin levels that I've seen have come off of people who have been on CD3, CD20 bispecifics. So I am looking for, in follicular lymphoma, something that can drive benefit and stop and put it back up on the shelf. And I think Mosun, as you can see here from a median PFS standpoint, as well as if you can get these patients into a CR at the end of treatment, can be very durable. Same thing for EPCO in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. Where I've used EPCO is in that patient population that I think is transforming clinically. They're behaving much more like large cell lymphoma. So I know EPCO has the motor to treat that occult transformation that I can't find on biopsy. But I ultimately know it's not a fixed duration therapy. It's something that's going to need to continue. And so from that standpoint, I am always looking, once they're in CR, as you can see here where the CRs are durable, for an opportunity to stop. I will comment from the journal of press release that EPCO FL1 was a positive trial that was announced on August 7th of 2025. Their phase 3 data showing that subcutaneous epcoritamab plus R-squared beat R-squared, and you can see the primary endpoint here of a dual primary endpoints of overall response rate and PFS. Not surprising, and came fresh off the heels of TAFA R-squared's win. What about frontline? We're moving on up here with bispecifics, and so this is looking at Mosun in untreated follicular lymphoma that met GELF criteria. I think the nice thing to see here is that this is now Mosun sub-Q instead of IV, so it's a different dosing strategy. So I often lean into it's 5 milligrams first, and then you multiply by 9 to get to 45, and magically it's 9 doses of Mosun. And so that's how I sink in my brain when I'm using sub-Q mosunetuzumab. And you can see here, great response rates, again, in frontline follicular lymphoma. I think the tail of this tape will be infections, though, as we motor through mosunetuzumab in frontline follicular lymphoma. Again, it doesn't appear to matter what your disease kind of status is for the potential efficacy for mosunetuzumab in frontline follicular lymphoma. You can see it works regardless of age, regardless of FLIPI score, elevated LDH, B symptoms, bulky disease, and grade of follicular lymphoma, which is going away in our pathologist microscope. I do want to comment about odronextamab, which has had a storied trying to get approved in the U.S., where it is approved in Europe. But this is really looking at what is the toughest nut to crack in my clinic, which is those early relapsing post-CAR T-cell patients. You don't often see too many races with the motorcycle, the CAR T, and the sidecar being the bispecific, but they are coming. They are coming for those patients who are not in CR at day 29. I do believe that that is an area for helping where CAR T-cells do need help, as well as those truly primary refractory patient populations. So clinical trials are coming to try to rescue CAR T, or at least support it. And here I think it's a little dip in the tall water of where I think Odroak is going, to where it can potentially salvage some patients who didn't get or progressed after CAR T-cell. You can see here, but it takes patience. So stable disease can become PR. PRs can be CRs over time. Yes, we need to do better with durability with our bispecifics after CAR T-cell. I don't have the slide for LOTIS-7, but I do believe that LOTIS-7 kind of gives us the glimmer of hope that two drugs can play nicely in the sandbox in the post-CAR T-cell arena. That's loncastuximab tesirine plus glofitamab. I know this is epcoritamab, but I would anticipate seeing more doublets in the post-CAR T-cell environment, especially if those trials allow early relapsing CAR T-cell, meaning those day 29 non-CR patient populations. And last, I want to talk about the supercharger, so the new class. So we know about blinatumomab. We know the struggles that blinatumomab had in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But this is cervatimig. And so this used to be known as letters and numbers, AZD0486. But this is our CD3, CD19 bispecific that comes with a more friendly administration schedule here. And you can see with dose escalation, there appears to be a dose response curve in regards to opportunities to not only have an overall response rate, but also a CR as we get higher and higher. So this is a drug to keep on your radar that may be coming to a clinical trial near you. And that clinical trial is the Soundtrack 1, which is an F1. This is where the theme kind of ends here. In regards to previously untreated follicular lymphoma, what you can see here is cervatimig plus rituximab in two different schedules versus dealer's choice. And with that, I don't know how I got it done, and I don't know how I'm awake, but I am fairly on time.
All right, good time. Good job there. So just to go back to the last thing you were talking about, Sonali, any thoughts about this agent? I'm kind of wondering why we didn't see a bispecific like this in the past. Any thoughts about where this is heading? And do we need to be looking for these antigens before we give these agents?
Yeah, really good questions. I think certainly in the frontline setting, the antigens are there universally. One of the slides I'm going to show is that even with the use of some of the bispecifics and with some of the enhanced anti-CD19, that antigen does get preserved. And so I think that's a very encouraging thought. The question as to whether, why this took so long to get here, as Matt just said, all of the bispecifics we have been CD3 by CD20, really kind of building a better rituximab, if you will, and some of them even bind the same epitope as rituximab does. With this one, with an anti-CD19 in the frontline setting, I think it really makes sense, and it reflects the technology that we can target CD19 with these drugs, because it's been much harder to target as a monotherapy and as a monoclonal antibody in the past without some of the enhancements we've had. I think the really exciting thing about this piece is, this is for high tumor burden follicular lymphoma. And the question is, do we need chemotherapy for patients with high tumor burden FL? And I think this will be a really great, great study to answer that question.
Same issues, CRS and ICANS?
Yeah, I mean, that is a really important question, is that, whether or not we're introducing a different kind of toxicity rather than chemo. There are ways to mitigate the CRS and the ICANS. ICANS with bispecifics is much lower than it is with CAR T, not zero, but it can be more subtle, I would say. So it'd be interesting to see what precautions they have to mitigate that.
So in a second, Matt, we're going to get into some of the questions from the audience. But one other thing I just wanted to bring up, I was going through in preparation for today things that were presented at ASCO and EHA. And I didn't get a chance to ask either one of you about this, but Matt, interesting paper, first-line therapy diffuse large B-cell from EHA, EBCO plus Pola-R-CHP. Right? And it was like 97% complete response rates, MRD, et cetera. Or is that where we're going to be heading?
Yeah, I think that's where the prospective trials that have zoomed through really the accrual, both with EPCO plus R-CHOP versus R-CHOP. This was a dip in the toe in the water, I think, to counter what is Glofit, Pola, R-CHP, you know, going up against Polarchip in the SkyGlow trial. You know, one of the things that I think that's been really nice to see kind of come out of these prospective clinical trials is really that high-risk patient population that really Polarix didn't solve, right? If you look at the PFS curves with R-CHOP and Polarchip, it didn't really solve that 15% of primary refractory patients. And I'm hoping that by adding bispecifics, as we find unique ways to get the patients who really need this higher therapies, which are IPI 4 to 5s, the people who are actually we're treating, we've all seen them on Friday nights where we have to treat the large cell lymphoma with some form of chemotherapy, and what happens to their ability to go on prospective clinical trials? You know, they're not there, right? We are now finally, you know, putting forth trials which allow patients to have gotten something and then get on the clinical trials. And I think it's because of leadership like Dr. Smith in regards to national trials and pushing against the regulatory agencies to be a little more innovative and a little more patient-centric, right, to get people that should be on clinical trials on their clinical trial.
So, Sonali, I'm really happy to say that yesterday we found out that we received a CME grant where we're going to be sending general medical oncologists from the community into CAR T centers to see like what's going on there and let us know about it, because it's kind of a little bit of a black box. But can you kind of provide a little bit of a macro perspective of the available CAR T products and where you see them, how you decide which one, if you have an option? As Matt brought up, that's not always the case, but assuming you do have the options, how do you see the difference? I was surprised, you know, I always thought about axi-cel as being the most effective, but, you know, you were showing the data with lysi-cel and even tisa-cel look pretty similar. So how do you, and it's always a problem in oncology, indirectly comparing, but how do you indirectly compare the three CAR T preparations, and how do you think about choice in diffuse large B-cell and FL?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it is logistics. First of all, congratulations on having a grant to be able to do that. You know, I think that's one of the biggest challenges is just the access and, you know, the comfort with being able to deliver, you know, some of these cell-based therapies. So I really, really love your, it takes a crew, you know, a pit crew. For me, I always say it takes a village. It just tells us where we're coming from. But, you know, when I'm looking at the three different products, lysi-cel does have an advantage in the sense that it has been used in older adults. And the vast majority of patients with relapsed refractory DLBCL, you know, tend to be on the older side. And so the safety profile there, along with the efficacy we recently saw, you know, kind of edges that out from a practical perspective in our center. However, axi-cel still, in my mind, has, you know, at least the sense. I mean, they're never going to be compared head-to-head, and this is the biggest challenge we have. But I get the sense that axi-cel has a fast turnaround. You have fewer out-of-spec products, and, you know, certainly is extremely active. And so if somebody has a more aggressive-feeling disease and they are younger and can tolerate some of the increased CRS, I would go maybe more towards axi-cel. I think tisa-cel still has a place. Certainly the turnaround time, if you guys remember, this was the one where the turnaround time took the longest, and so people ended up needing more salvage regimens in between, and then you lost your window. I think that that has improved, and it's somewhere in the middle.
So what about the CAR T and follicular, Matt? You know, when I first saw the CAR T data, and you think about, as you were saying, the long history in follicular lymphoma, thinking, well, bispecifics seem, you know, so much better, much better tolerated. But actually, the data with CAR T and follicular is pretty impressive, and it's kind of a one and done thing. Where are you thinking about, what situation would you bring in CAR T with FL and which product?
Yeah, the beauty of follicular lymphoma is that for the vast majority of the time in relapse refractory, you've had years of time to get to understand your patient, their family, and what they can, you know, can do. And so I've typically parked bispecifics before CAR T-cell in relapse refractory follicular lymphoma from that standpoint. But now there are so many great trials that are either putting bispecifics in frontline or in second line, as we just saw. So bispecifics are moving up. One of the cautionary tales, I think, that can come out of follicular lymphoma is we're driving a bit blind in regards to the true outcomes of CAR T-cell after bispecifics in follicular lymphoma. And so while we're not really seeing a lot of prospective trials that are studying this, we will over time see this, but it will likely be done in the guise of a real-world experience of CAR T cell after follicular lymphoma because they had gotten antecedent or prior bispecifics on a clinical trial. It is incredibly important, and one of the things that I needle the makers of CAR T-cells, it's incredibly important for them to understand what the last therapy was. We learned our lesson from bendamustine. We must not make the same mistake with bispecifics, because as Dr. Smith alluded to, if you start seeing out-of-spec rates go up, if you start seeing manufacturing failures go up, if the efficacy is not the same that we once saw, we should be staying curious and asking the question, why? And that answer may be, what did the bispecific do to the T cell?
So, Sonali, you know, we're always asking investigators, surveying questions and all. We asked something, we did a survey for the SOHO meeting recently. We never thought to ask this before. It was kind of interesting. We asked investigators, what percent of patients that you would normally present CAR T for to as an option for, let's say, diffuse large B cell, actually are having it presented? Mm-hmm. And it was like uniformly estimate around 25%, mm-hmm. that a lot of people are not getting referred to CAR T.
Yeah.
Is that actually the case, and why?
Yeah, I think that, you know, so much of this has to do with shared decision-making as well as the access and the communication between a community site and a center that does CAR-T. I think by the time somebody gets referred for CAR-T, they take the trip up to Hyde Park to see anybody in our group, you know, they already have an idea that this is going to be a good opportunity for them. And I think the data is really compelling that out of all of the tools we have right now in the relapse refractory setting, CAR-T gives us the longest durability for those patients who respond. So I think by the time they get there, if their mentality is there for that, they do end up going. But the problem is that many people are either never referred, or if they are referred, it is daunting to think about going to a center, parking, being there for 3 weeks in the hospital, or maybe a little bit less, but and then having restrictions afterwards. So I think there's still a really important place for non-CAR T options for people to be treated closer to home. And then just one last thing, I mean, you know, it's the logistics of going back and forth. Again, so many of our patients are older. They rely on children who work to bring them back and forth, and it may not be an option.
So, Matt, I wonder also maybe if some of the lack of referral might be of people thinking that it's more toxic than it actually is. From your point of view, what do you consider eligibility? Obviously, we get into age, but comorbidities, what specific type of comorbidities? I think a lot of people think autologous transplant, but it's a different story.
Yeah, I think that that's a great perspective for somebody who does this all the time, just not some of the time. You know, and one of the first things I say is that there is no age limit to CAR T-cell, okay? And I think we've seen that not only in prospective clinical trials, but in real-world experience. And so to say because somebody is 83, I'm just using that number, versus 67, you know, means CAR T-cell ineligible versus eligible. I think we've also learned, you know, with regards to comorbidities, that we should be paying attention to what is the lymphoma comorbidity and what is a non-lymphoma comorbidity as we march through CAR T cells. So in that respect, I still think it's a lot of logistics, right? And as we've seen the barriers being brought down to doing CAR T cell from the government, we were screaming like, where did you come up with 8 weeks from? I don't know. You know, well, now it's 2 weeks that they can't drive, right? Where did you come up with that they have to be there for 28 days within 120 miles or 120 minutes? I don't know. You know, we just made it up. So with data, the government has actually thrown us a bone, right, to get these patients back to the community sooner. But the community has to be ready to accept these patients. So both on the front end of getting the patients in, if we're going to be asking the community to take them back earlier, we need to provide the infrastructure, the knowledge, and the data to say that it's safe. And we finally have that data. That data will see the light of day. It saw it at ASCO, it saw it at EHA, it saw it at ICML. It will see the light of day in a prospective journal showing that the excitement, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in the first 14 days. And so we can paint a better journey to you, that we can get these patients back to you safely, that we also can paint the picture for the patients, that we can get them back to their homes, to their beds, to their communities, safely and potentially back to their work sooner.
So, Nelly, what about the issue of prophylactic tocilizumab, either in CAR-T or bispecific? I think I see that being used more in myeloma for some reason. What about in lymphoma?
Yeah, we don't have as much prophylactic toci use, but one thing, you know, and this really picks up on what Matt was just talking about, is that we've learned a lot. You know, when CAR-T first came around, you know, we saw really significant toxicity. We were scared to use steroids that we would kill the T-cell. We were scared to use certain things, you know, that we thought would, you know, reduce the efficacy. And, you know, people had more side effects, more CRS because of that. And where things have evolved to now is that we are much better about knowing how to use steroids, how to preemptively use steroids, and hopefully avoid the need for toci. That being said, I completely agree with Matt. You know, most of the excitement is in the first several weeks, maybe the first month if you want to be really conservative. And after that, you start to get into more of the chronic issues related to CAR-T, such as hypogammaglobulinemia, you know, complete B-cell depletion, and some of the other, you know, cytopenias that can happen. But, you know, in terms of CRS and ICANS, it is we know now, which we did not know before, is that it's pretty limited to the acute phase.
So, Matt, actually, one of these QR code things we did was on myeloma, and we interviewed a few people with who got CAR-T. Several had neurologic issues, but they have an agent there, cilta-cel, that does some Parkinsonian thing. But now we're doing a program. I'm interviewing people who got CAR-T for lymphoma, and several of them had, like, tremors and delayed neurologic issues. What do you see, first of all, in terms of ICANS, when do you see it? What do you see? And what about other, you know, neurologic things after CAR-T?
I think this is one of the most fun parts of doing cellular therapy is you actually get to be an internist again, right? We actually can examine patients. We can think back to what milkmaid's hands were, you know, with regards to, you know, encephalopathic patients, headaches. And for the vast majority of time, when patients have ICANS, it's not you. It's not you. It's not the APP. It's not the nurse. It's the caregiver sitting in the room saying, my husband is not the same person, you know, or my wife, you know, like she never asked for that. And then what happens 4 to 6 hours later?
Have a fever.
That's when the ICANS comes on. And you don't need an ICE score to do it. You need an ICE score to satisfy your CIBMTR reporting, paperwork. One of the things that I think is incredibly important when you talk about ICANS is how you talk about it to the patient and how you talk about it to the caregiver. Because it is incredibly scary for the family. The patients, it's an amnestic experience for them. They wake up, it's Wednesday, right? No, it's Saturday. In that regard, early intervention matters. What is your goal with ICANS? It is prevent grade 3-4 ICANS, right? Because that's the length of stay extender. That's the patient that ends up in this the acute rehab facility. And so that's what people remember. We're really good at CRS. To Dr. Smith's point, we are really good at managing CRS. And I think with early CRS mitigation and treatment of grade, you risk mitigate down your ICANS.
That's what I'm really interested to hear from these general oncologists when they go visit your centers, the granularity, the day-to-day care that it's hard to figure out when you're kind of on the outside. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. All right, Sonali, let's talk. There's a lot more going on in lymphoma besides bispecific and CAR-T. Let's talk about it.
Okay. So, you know, there is a tremendous amount of data coming out, and I just sort of put it into a couple of different buckets for treatment-naive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, relapse-refractory, and then relapse-refractory follicular lymphoma, and then I'll touch on some of the ADCs that are here. So, you know, just to start with frontline diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I mean, this is old news now, but, you know, just to remind everybody, the Polarix trial was really a groundbreaking study in many ways. You know, for over 2 decades, we've been trying to beat our CHOP, and nothing has ever shown a difference until this trial came. It had the highest bar of what we have for clinical trials. It was randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, Phase 3 international study of Pola-R-CHP, the antibody drug conjugate against CD79 versus R-CHOP. And importantly, this was for high-risk patients, so this was for IPI 2 to 5, and cell of origin was not a stratification factor, and I'm going to come back to that. So the original data we saw showed that at 2 years, there's an absolute 6.5% improvement in the progression-free survival. So what's new now? What was published earlier this year is that we now have the 5-year update. And at 5 years, the curves remain separated. There is a persistent progression-free survival advantage for the Pola-R-CHP arm. There's no overall survival advantage when you look at the overall population. If you look at the forest plot, what you can see is that pretty much all of the groups they looked at, older, younger, you know, different IPIs, et cetera, they all seem to have similar degrees of benefit. And I'll just call out maybe one or two things. One is that germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphoma may not have had the same degree of benefit. And the other is that double hit and triple hit did not have the same amount of benefit. When looking at this in a little bit more detail, what's really exciting is that in some of these subgroups, remember, in the overall population, we did not see an overall survival advantage, but in some of the subgroups now, we do see it. And there is a really exciting overall survival advantage in the nanostring-based ABC diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, so you can see the difference between ABC and germinal center at the bottom left. The other sort of surprising piece is that high-grade B-cell lymphoma also had a survival advantage for Pola-R-CHP. And I thought this is, I'd like to learn a little bit more about this because many of the high-grade B-cell lymphomas we think about are actually double hit or triple hit. So who are these people? It's a small number of people, but, you know, still it's something that is very intriguing and exciting. So the question now becomes, you know, are we ready for prime time? Can we have precision medicine where we've got this cell of origin-based approach? And I'll just say that Pola-R-CHP, in the frontline setting suggests that you could do this for the non-germinal center DLBCL. But I just want to bring everybody's attention to some other approaches. So one is by using BTK inhibitors. And what we see on the left is the Phoenix trial, which was an older study that's already read out, and it was R-CHOP with or without ibrutinib for nanostring-based non-germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This was a negative study. And why was it a negative study? Well, there were a couple of reasons. One is that there was increased mortality in those patients who were over the age of 65. There's also this gap from diagnosis to treatment. So in other words, just what Matt said, if somebody's really sick, they are too sick to make it onto the study. So only the best of the worst, if you will, made it onto the trial. And so maybe there was a bigger bar to clear to find some differences. There's also underlying genomic heterogeneity. So what's happening now is the ESCALADE study, which is on the right. This is still accruing. This is R-CHOP with or without the next, second generation covalent BTK inhibitor, acalabrutinib. And this is limited to people under the age of 75. And it allows a cycle of R-CHOP, and gene expression profiling will be used to determine the cell of origin. So maybe we'll make a difference. Now, one of the things that is happening, and you know, you alluded to this too, Neil, was you know, R-CHOP plus X. There's so many different studies that are out there. There's golcadamide plus R-CHOP. There's glofit plus R-CHOP, epco plus R-CHOP, odronextamab plus R-CHOP, and even tafa-len polituzumab R-CHOP. So you know, these you know, building on R-CHOP in an unselected way is targeted, but it's not precision. So what's happening on the precision approach? I'll just tell you that in hopefully another year or two, we will have the LymphoMatch launched. This is being run through the U.S. Intergroup, and this is using the Dana-Farber generated DLB class to classify diffuse large B-cell lymphoma into one of five different categories based on genomic profile, structural variants, as well as FISH and cytogenetics. And so hopefully we'll have some approach for precision. Now, switching to relapsed and refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, you heard a little bit about STARGLOW, and although Matt didn't go into all of the politics of this, just to let everybody know, this was a really nicely designed study in my mind, which was R-GemOx against R-GemOx plus glofitamab for a fixed duration in relapsed refractory large B-cell lymphoma. And these curves you see here are overall survival. There is an overall survival advantage in the relapse refractory setting over just chemoimmunotherapy. And you would think this is really exciting. There's a doubling of overall survival, 12.9 months to 25.5 months. Unfortunately, the FDA kind of said, well, too many of these patients were treated ex-US. You know, they questioned some of the data. This was not approved, but it is listed in NCCN. And I think for somebody who doesn't want to go for CAR-T and is still appropriate for chemo, this would be something I would think about. But the other piece is that there are antibody-drug conjugates also building on R-GemOx, and this is kind of a theme. You know, in relapse and refractory follicular lymphoma, everybody's building on R-squared. In relapse refractory DLBCL, everybody's building on R-GemOx. You can say that's right or wrong, but that's kind of the theme of what's happening. So here is polatuzumab vedotin added to R-GemOx against R-GemOx alone, and again, you see that the overall survival favors the antibody drug conjugate. And, you know, the difference isn't as dramatic as STARGLOW, but, you know, I think this is also a non-CAR-T, non-bispecific opportunity for people to consider. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that polatuzumab seemed to have similar efficacy in the relapse refractory setting in both GC and non-GC subsets. And so, you know, maybe there's something different about these patients. Maybe in the relapse refractory setting, this is less important. And certainly, you know, this is very interesting from a biologic perspective. Now, a couple of other things I want to mention is that Tafa-Len, as all of you know, has been available for relapse refractory large B-cell lymphoma based on a phase 2 trial. We now have 5-year data, which is the graphs to the left. And what you can see is that especially if it's used in the first line of treatment, the overall survival is not even reached for those patients who get Tafa-Len second line. And then on the right side, I have some real-world data. The top bar, graph table is PFS, the bottom is OS, and the summary of it is in the blue there, which is the body of evidence right now for Tafa-Len is that it's best for second line DLBCL, non-bulky, good performance status, and those patients who get a CR actually can do really well. And again, if you want to keep people closer to home, I think, you know, there are patients who are appropriate for this. And then finally for this piece is loncastuximab tesirine. So this is an antibody drug conjugate that has a PBD dimer payload, so that's a chemotherapy agent. And the LOTIS-2 trial, which was a single-arm phase 2 study, showed that those patients who had a CR, that's the top line in the blue, actually you can see like a, you know, that there is a plateau on the curve, whereas those patients who have a PR or a progression obviously don't do as well. But I think this is really intriguing for a single agent that's given once every 3 weeks and is relatively well tolerated. So what's happening now with loncastuximab is that we have a confirmatory trial, again, Lonca-R versus R-GemOx. This is in the relapse refractory DLBCL setting, and the safety run-in was recently presented, and it's pretty intriguing. Out of 20 patients, small numbers, I get it, but, you know, the overall response rate is 80%, and the CR rate is 50% with no new safety signals. And then we also have a combination with glofitamab that also looks really exciting with an 87% CR rate, low CRS, and a dose expansion part is underway. Switching to follicular lymphoma in the last minute, we know that there's a ton of options for this. We just kind of pick something out of the toolkit. We have no idea about sequencing. We kind of talk to the patient. Here's the spectrum of options. Pick one. Now we have Tafa-Len plus rituximab and Lonca-R. So this is based, the first one is based on the InMind trial, which is a randomized phase 3 double-blind R-squared versus R-squared with or without Tafa in relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. This was a time-limited treatment for 1 year, and the main findings are shown here, which is that Tafa added to R-squared improves upon R-squared alone, and this is for progression-free survival, duration of response, and time to next treatment. In terms of toxicity, there was not significant added toxicity, which I think is, you know, really great to know. And then the other piece, which we had talked about earlier, remember that tafasitamab is an anti-CD19 antibody that patients retain their CD19 expression, so if they go on to get CAR-T later, this isn't off the table. Now, Lonca-R also now has been added to the NCCN guidelines. This is based on a phase 2 trial with 39 patients with short follow-up, but this has a really high-risk population, including many people with early progression of disease, and you can see that there is certainly a lot of promising activity. And then last in this category is the Rosewood study, which we talked about maybe last time, which is zanubrutinib obinutuzumab. We always thought BTK inhibitors weren't active in follicular lymphoma. And then this study came around, which looked at ZO versus O in a high-risk population of patients and showed that the CR rate, the duration of response, PFS, all favor the combination. And if you look at, you know, the curves, you know, certainly adding this BTK inhibitor to a monoclonal antibody improves outcomes. outcomes for our patients. This past year at ASH, we heard that this was independent of what their last prior treatment was. Didn't matter if they had two lines of treatments or three lines of treatments or more. And so I think this is absolutely an appropriate option. And then just the last slide I have here, I didn't put in all the data because it's a lot, and it's all very preliminary, but I think the CELMoDs, which have been very exciting in myeloma, are making their way to lymphoma. And I think all of you know that the CELMoDs are essentially cereblon inhibitors that are much more potent against cereblon than currently available immunomodulatory agents, and they decrease the transcription factors, Icarus and Aiolos. And this decreases some of the proteins that are responsible for perpetuating lymphoma survival and may also have some microenvironment effects. So there's a lot going on, including adding these agents up front, adding them after CAR-T, looking at them as single agents, and hopefully when this is discussed next year, we'll have some more data. So,
awesome, Sonali. So just to pick up on a few things, you know, Matt, we were talking earlier this morning in the breast session. They kind of surprised me. They were talking about curing a fraction of people with metastatic breast cancer with ADCs, particularly the HER2 ADCs. And, you know, when you think about ADCs, it seems like chemo, you know, whatever. I was kind of surprised to hear that. And then looking at that ELOKA-T, when that the top curve there was interesting as well. And then the ELOKA-R. Any comments about using ELOKA-T, where you see that having got bispecifics and everything else, but where do you see ELOKA-T fitting in? And what's your experience with tolerability? And also, where does corticosteroids fit in preventing toxicity?
I'll go through it backwards. When I talk about ELOKA-T, I call it ELOKA-T DEX, because it is incredibly clear that the dexamethasone is an important feature to the regimen in risk mitigation of toxicities. Those toxicities, namely, are peripheral edema, pleural effusions, pericardial effusions that can come over time. So I talk about being an internist. It's an internist's drug also, right? You have to listen to the bases of the lungs, listening for crackles. You have to examine the pretibial space because spironolactone is the diuretic of choice with ELOKA, not furosemide. You know, and so as we start to walk through these new novel classes of drugs with new novel payloads, the toxicity expectedly is different. The other thing that comes around with ELOKA is sun exposure. And you can see Dr. Alricio did the a prospective experience that led to the NCCN guidelines listing it. And where's Dr. Alricio? He's in Miami, right? One of arguably the sunniest places in this country, right? Am I correct in that I live in not the sunniest place of the country? But, you know, talking with him, it is upfront education about staying out of the sun, both UVA, UVB, from that standpoint, and you can risk mitigate the rashes. I think ELOKA will have a place in follicular lymphoma. It will be interesting to see if it recapitulates the large cell data, which is it didn't matter what line of therapy that you used it, it had the potential for benefit. And I think the unique aspect of ELOKA for large cell lymphoma is going to be that it appears from the LOTIS-7 data that it may actually make bispecifics just a little bit more tolerable. Right, and so it's an easy 30-minute infusion every 3 weeks, and if you compare that with a bispecific, I really think that could be impactful for that population also.
Anything you would add in terms of your experience with ELOKA-T? Have you seen long-term responses?
Yeah, I have. You know, it kind of goes back to, you had one of the questions we didn't necessarily touch on, but it's the whole, you know, DLBCL-FL balance, right? Like,
right.
Sometimes you have patients that have diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, they recur with a follicular, then they have another transformation, then they have follicular again. And, you know, I found that ELOKA is, you know, very well tolerated in my more frail patients. I think the durability is there. It's probably one of the easier, out of all the things we've mentioned, this is one of the easier ones to administer.
Interesting. Also, Matt, in terms of the CELMoDs, I was kind of thinking about where does lenalidomide fit in with lymphomas and, you know, R-squared, I guess. I mean, do you see, you know, R-CELMoD, or where are the CELMoDs going to come in?
Yeah, I think that they're being intercalated across many different areas of our indolent lymphomas as well as large cell lymphoma, being couched as the next, you know, to unseat lenalidomide both in follicular lymphoma and to try again, you know, like we tried with R-squared, our CHOP, you know, in the large cell lymphoma experience. But with that comes a whole new learning around how to manage kind of these cell mods, because it isn't the similar dosing schedule that you see with lenalidomide. Lower doses, more powerful, from that standpoint. And it's a crowded space, you know, right now. And so in that, I think it does have probably the hardest path or one of the harder paths forward.
I'm waiting for it to come into myeloma. We've been hearing about it for so long. I think they may be better tolerated in a lot of situations. But Sonali, another thing you brought up was the issue of BTK inhibitors, which seems like I'm starting to hear more about it, particularly with this Rosewood study. Can you talk about right now how you think about integrating BTK inhibitors into lymphoma treatment? Are you using the Rosewood regimen? Any thoughts about what we're going to see with diffuse large B-cell up front in the non-GCB?
Yeah. So BTK inhibitors are very important across a variety of lymphomas, but if we're going to stick to follicular and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, you know, I think in follicular lymphoma, this is one where, you know, the Rosewood study really did change my mind on how what BTK inhibitors can do for this disease. We all know that B-cell receptor signaling is important in follicular lymphoma, and yet many of the monotherapy studies with ibrutinib, you know, were negative trials. There was really minimal response rate. And so to see this response, that it's not just the antibody doing the work, that the BTK inhibitor is adding to what obinutuzumab does, I think is really, really encouraging. And my guess is that it will remain, you know, it is a crowded space, but my guess is that it will remain as a good option for follicular lymphoma, and not really sure where it's going to go further in follicular. In DLBCL, though, I think it is going to go further, at least in terms of investigations, and some of that has to do with that DLB class lymphomatch schema that I showed you, which is that if you look at the different clusters, we now understand that diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, it's not just gene expression profiling, but there are genomic variations that might allow for certain subgroups to respond really well to a BTK inhibitor, in particular the C5 subset of that particular classification system. So I think we're going to see more of BTK inhibitors in the frontline setting.
So, Matt, a common question we hear from oncologists, and something we've been asking for a while, is when do you use Pola-R-CHP? And do you think that the cell of origin testing in the community is as reliable as what you see? Are you okay with the community-based oncologist having the testing done locally and making a decision based on that? Also, somebody in the audience says, what about Pola-R-CHP for a patient who's HIV positive? I'm not sure exactly why, but you tell me.
So I'll tackle the first one. I think that the Hans or Choi methodology through immunohistochemistry is what the 99% are getting right now in large B-cell lymphoma. You know, I call out the PATH reports even at my own institution that if you're going to tell me it's ABC, then that means it was done by NanoString, right? If it's non-GCB, it means that it was done by by IHC. Now, with regards to GCB standpoint, if it's CD10 positive, you're done, you know, in regards to IHC for the vast majority. And so in that setting, when do I use Pola-R-CHP in a GCB patient? Well, I reflect back to the study that Dr. Smith went through. It was the creme de la creme study. It was not stratified for cell of origin. There are inherently that population that we are in the dark on, which is those dark zone population, which lives within that 20% of GCBs that we cannot figure out who they are underneath the microscope without reflexive molecular testing. And even in that population, they appeared to do a little bit better. I think there were that high-grade B-cell lymphoma population that kind of lived and overlapped there. So without additive toxicity, which we didn't see in Polarix, you know, and if you can get access to it, then I typically, if it's 2 to 5, regardless of cell of origin, I'm giving Pola-R-CHP because I think that's the backbone to build off of.
Sonali?
I was just going to say the exact same thing, which is that despite the fact that we perseverate on the different subsets, remember, it was not powered for those subsets, and I would follow the label, which is IPI 2 to 5. You know, even if there isn't this huge advantage or the survival advantage, there's no decrease in it. And we don't know enough about how immunohistochemistry assigns these categories, and so I would just follow the label.
I'll comment on the HIV patient population.
Oh, yeah.
I do continue to use dose-adjusted EPOCH-R in the caveats around CD4 counts and large B-cell lymphoma, reductions of cytoxin, you know, all of those things that in this niche population, because interpreting the PET scans can be incredibly hard. What are they coming on antiviral therapy? Are they not coming on antiretroviral therapy? All of these aspects, I think that I very respect that population. It is a curative intent population in 2025, but I still think without other prospective data, I have stuck to the kind of the EPOCH regimen.
So, Sonali, questions about outpatient initiation of bispecifics and also the role of the community-based oncologists and bispecifics, specifically well-tolerated agents like mosunetuzumab. We had a case presented by a general medical oncologist in the California area. We wanted to put the patient on Mosun. The patient wouldn't go to the tertiary center. It was too far of a drive, so the doc said, okay, did it. You know, the patient called in a few days later, said, I have a fever. She recommended some corticosteroids. The patient did great. Where are we heading in terms of moving this into the community? A lot of times now, patients will get started in the tertiary center, then they go to the community. Do you see this starting in the community?
Yeah. I think that we are seeing that shift, that it no longer, I mean, I think still today, many people will get started in the tertiary center and then complete their treatment closer to home. But I think that is shifting, particularly because, you know, being able to deliver the bispecifics in the community just takes organization. It takes that village, that pit crew, you know, where you put it together. Maybe not as extensive as we needed for the CAR T cell, but you have to have an educated patient, an educated caregiver, an educated nursing staff, and ER staff as well, and to have tocilizumab on hand. And if you have all of that, you know, I think it's extremely feasible to give bispecifics in the community. There was a publication, I'll just give a little shout out, in Blood about a year and a half ago, which was a consensus statement about how to deliver bispecific agents in the community. And I just encourage you to take a look at that.
So what about tafasitamab, Matt? And, you know, tafasitamab combined with R-squared, as you said, everything's getting combined with R-squared. I mean, we definitely need something like AI or something to help us figure this thing out. But where are things right now in terms of your use of tafasitamab?
Yeah, so when I'm using TAFA-R-squared, I think the biggest barrier to actually implementing TAFA-R-squared is the lenalidomide, right? Figuring out the right dose and then secondarily the right patient. And I agree with Dr. Smith's kind of summary statements there of where I'm using TAFA-R-squared or where I'm having that discussion is exactly in that patient population. But I'm also reflective on what the creatinine clearance is, because the best way to get patients to not want to take cycle two of TAFA-R-squared is to overdose the lenalidomide, right? And so I'm if their creatinine clearance is hovering, you know, 55 2 months ago, then it's 63, and then it's 50, and then they come in for cycle one and it's 70, they're going to feel that lenalidomide, and I inherently often lower the dose from that standpoint and then ease into it, right? Because what does large cell lymphoma love? Large cell lymphoma loves patients who can't take their medicine.
Anything you want to add to that about tafasitamab?
Yeah, I mean, I think that tafa-len is a well-tolerated agent. You know, within SWOG, we actually have a study that's available to everybody to open through NCTN, which is tafa-len with or without tazemetostat or tafa-len with or without zanubrutinib for relapse refractory large B-cell lymphoma. And although the data is still maturing, you know, I can tell you that it's a good backbone to use, understanding that there is renal clearance issues with the lenalidomide.
So what about low-volume follicular lymphoma, Matt, in situations right now where we're looking, where we're using rituximab? I know bispecifics are being looked at in that situation. Where do you see that heading?
Yeah, so I still follow the principle that, you know, the treatment should never be worse than the disease, right? And so I think very hard and have many conversations with my follicular lymphoma patients about starting therapy, especially if they don't meet GELF criteria, right? So you have the low burden worrying that can't get their head to the pillow at night, that they know that they have follicular lymphoma, they can feel it, they can see it, so they need it treated. And I still think our monotherapy in that patient population is a great therapy. I want to see longer data. I know that there's a low burden bispecific trial going on, but you know, I want to see that comparatively to what the toxicity profile of our monotherapy is there too, from an infection standpoint. Understandably, both are going to be fixed duration therapies. I also reflect upon what Pod 24 is, and I'm a big methodologic person in this regards because I think we've had the watering down of Pod 24 in follicular lymphoma to the point where a lot of times in the prospective trials now, it's not capital POD 24, it's lowercase POD 24 because they truly weren't the original POD 24 patients that were studied in the Kosulo paper. And so you've got to remember and reflect back when you see Pod 24's equivalency across these prospective trials, was it truly the Pod 24s that were originally included in the papers? Undoubtedly, I think it's a different patient population, okay? But not all Pod 24s need treatment right away also. So it's also about how you find the relapse in follicular lymphoma in regards to Pod 24s.
Anything you want to add to that in terms of the early relapsers, Sonali?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about CAR-T in this space. And, you know, for better or for worse, I am reserving that more for third-line therapy. And I think that second-line therapy, we have all of these other options, you know, for follicular lymphoma, including, you know, some of the bispecifics. But it's really that third-line space that is where I start to think more about CAR-T. First-line, I agree, you know, rituximab alone is very appropriate, but I'm going to put a plug in for S2308, which is another SWOG study for low tumor burden patients, randomizing patients between rituximab monotherapy or mosunetuzumab, and I think, you know, hopefully the deeper remissions with some of the bispecifics will make rituximab monotherapy obsolete.
What are you expecting to see in that study, though, in terms of infections?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a limited state, it's a limited duration of treatment, and we'll see what that shows. You know, I think rituximab alone can also have lots of infections. You know, there's an increased risk of COVID, you know, during the pandemic we saw. I don't know how much more mosunetuzumab will add.
So thank you very much. Awesome job. Thank you all for attending. Have a great day. Thank you so much.